Welcome to episode 289 of FBI Retired Case File Review with Jerry Williams. I'm a retired agent on a mission to show you who the FBI is and what the FBI does through my books, my blog, and my podcast case reviews with former colleagues. Today, we get to speak to retired agent Scott Payne, who served in the FBI for 23 years. In this episode, Scott reviews his undercover role in the investigation that resulted in averting a mass shooting at a synagogue by a copycat white supremacist who said he wanted to do something similar to the June 17, 2015 massacre of church attendees in Charleston, South Carolina, only he wanted to do something bigger. Fortunately, the person he asked to get him a gun to use was FBI undercover agent Scott Payne. During his FBI career, Scott was assigned to the New York field office, the San Antonio field office at the McAllen Resident Agency, and the Knoxville Division. During these assignments, he led investigations targeting drug trafficking organizations, special interest alien smuggling organizations, gangs, violent crime, criminal enterprises, public corruption, and domestic terrorism. Throughout his FBI career, Scott was the primary undercover agent in numerous long-term undercover operations. These undercover operations included violent crime, motorcycle gangs, public corruption, murder for hire, drug trafficking organizations, and domestic terrorism groups with international ties. Scott was also an FBI SWAT team operator for over 7 years, participating in numerous arrests of violent criminals and execution of search warrants. As an instructor in firearms, defensive tactics, and undercover, he has trained thousands of state and local law enforcement officers throughout the United States in various certification schools. Even in retirement, Scott continues to travel and teach undercover and tactical schools to law enforcement. He is also pursuing a career in the film and TV industry. His memoir, working title, Pale Horse, How I Became the Undercover Nazi, will be published in spring of 2024. Now, before we get to the interview, I wanted to let you know that when this episode is released on May 31st, 2023, I'll be at Thriller Fest in New York. Now, for those of you who don't know, Thriller Fest is the premier conference for thriller and crime fiction enthusiasts, writers, and fans. I've attended at least, I think it's 10 times now. Not only am I teaching my session on writing authentic FBI characters, presenting an award at the banquet, sitting on a panel talking about publishing pathways, but I'm also interviewing on stage best-selling author Walter Mosley. Plus, and I haven't told you anything about this, but my literary agent will have my latest novel out on submission for a book deal. This past month has been crazy as I make revisions to my third crime novel and preparations for the conference. If you want to know how things worked out at Thriller Fest, I'll write all about it in my June email to reader team members. Plus, I wrote a review for the new Hulu series, Class of 09. Full disclosure, I was an FBI consultant for the TV show. I'll send out that June email by Tuesday, June 6th. Just give me a couple days once I get home from New York. In your podcast app's description of this episode, there's a link to the show notes at jerrywilliams.com. You'll also find links to where you can buy me a coffee, join my reader team, which is all about crime fiction, and learn more about me and my books. Thank you for your support. Now here's the show. I want to welcome my guest, retired agent Scott Payne. Hey, Scott, how are you?
Doing good, Jerry. How you doing?
I'm doing good, too. I should tell everyone that we both are a little under the weather, so our voices are a little deeper than normal, but I think we'll get through it. As you know, I like to do a case review first, talking about a case from the beginning, predication, to sentencing. And we're going to do that today. but we are also going to talk to you about working undercover. I also want to say congratulations. I know you have a book deal.
I do.
And that book will come out, I take it, sometime at the end of next year?
Actually, we're pushing for March, April, May, somewhere in
there. Oh, wow. When the book comes out, you promised me to come back and talk about your biggest case, which is The Base, where you went undercover with an extremist domestic terrorist group. And tell us all about the weird stuff that happened, like the ritual killing of the ram, which turned out to be a goat.
Yeah, it was some wild times.
I just was looking over an article that was in Rolling Stone about you, which I'll link in the show notes for this episode.
The Rolling Stone article, it was a blessing, but at the end of the day, it's an interview. Somebody's interviewing you and they write how their verbiage goes. Not necessarily my voice, but I thought it was a pretty good article.
I enjoyed it. Certainly was entertaining. I mean, it talks about your many undercover roles, your dozens of undercover roles, infiltrating drug enterprises, Nazis, biker gangs, the KKK, and all kinds of extremist domestic terrorism groups. The article gives us a taste. The book will give us a full meal. And today we'll get, I guess I'll call it a tease.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Who are we going to talk about today? What is the case that we're going to review today?
We'll talk about a guy named Benjamin McDowell. He was a white supremacist living near Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He was actually in Conway, but the closest big town is Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The way it kind of came about was the FBI's got field offices everywhere. Case agents are building cases. The Birmingham office had a source. And essentially what happened was is the Ku Klux Klan, they would have these rallies open to anybody, just trying to recruit and stuff. This guy, Benji, shows up at one of the rallies. He gets naturalized as a Klan member. But even in the Klan world, he was way too radical. Like, he started scaring locals because of the stuff he was talking. So people started reporting it. And I'd seen the canvas and I answered it. And I got picked for the role.
Could you back up a little bit?
Yes, ma'am.
Because there are people who are listening that don't know what the canvas is.
A lot of times, to find undercovers, let's just say you've got 600 certified undercover employees in the FBI. Generally, what would happen is, if you didn't know anybody and you didn't know who you wanted to use for the case, headquarters would send out a canvas looking for a certain type of person, background, size, color, you name it. They could be as detailed as, I need a Mandarin Chinese speaker. I've actually seen some that say, I need somebody familiar with motorcycles, familiar with tattoos, lifts weights.
And you would go check, check, check.
Yes. Yeah. That. Yeah. Or you start getting emails from your friends going, is this you? So I see the canvas. I respond to the case team and I end up getting picked. We were getting along pretty good. And that's kind of how it usually goes. I fly in to Myrtle Beach, meet the case team. We start getting the brief on this guy and how radical he's been. And the gist of it is he's a felon. He's already done time. He is telling everybody he's got the heart. He wants to do something bad. He's starting to scare people. And he even sends a picture of a synagogue near Myrtle Beach to one of the members. So they're nervous and they do the right thing, which is notify the FBI or law enforcement. Hey, we got concerns about this guy kind of thing. So I go down and my role, I was introduced by a friendly source. Benji believed I was a longtime white supremacist because of my age. I can't say I'm a young person. I'll break it down for you like this. Towards the end of my career, they would refer to me as National Socialist 1.0 because I'm an older guy. I've got tattoos, all this stuff. Whereas the National Socialist 2.0 might be younger kids, clean cut, no tattoos, trying to infiltrate the government, stuff like that. I was a 1.0 guy, and he believed that I had worked with Aryan Nations and skinheads and stuff. Essentially, he believed that I was what I like to refer to as a closer. I've done that role a couple of times in different cases, as many of my peers had too, or mentors even. He looks at me as somebody that can get him what he needs. If he needs a gun, I'll get it. If he needs a bomb, I can get it. That kind of thing. We go down, meet the case team. I think Conway's about a 45-minute ride from Myrtle Beach. So I go out to Conway. I pick him up, and we're driving. It's our first face-to-face meet, and we're driving. He's a little squirrely, a little odd-acting, but kind of a thicker boy. Got some white supremacy tattoos, shaved head. And we're driving back to Myrtle Beach to my hotel room to know each other, see what it is he's actually doing, which is what we do a lot of times as investigators and as undercovers. You've got the predication to open the case. You checked all your marks as far as this is legit. We can open the case, But sometimes you go into a case and you can be in it 6 months and find out, look, there's nothing here. Or sometimes you go in and you find out, wow, this is a lot more than we thought. At this point, we're driving. And I remember a couple of things. We're driving in this rental car and I see Benji start to roll a joint, marijuana, which is kind of not a big deal right now as far as most of the United States goes. But at least at that time, it was illegal in South Carolina. And he's starting to roll and I'm thinking, man, this guy's getting ready to light a joint in the car. Not a huge deal, but I've got this source with me and I'm kind of thinking, well, is he going to smoke? You know, you start going through all these things in your head because as a seasoned agent, undercover coordinator, whatever, if you're administratively pure, you start thinking of all these things and what do we need to check and what do we not need to check? So we're driving and I just ad-libbed. I just look back in my rearview mirror and I look at Benji and I said, hey, Benji, let me ask you a question. I said, is marijuana legal in South Carolina? And he says, no. And I said, well, then what makes you think you can roll a joint in my car? And even the store kind of looked at me and he's like, well, I said, listen, you don't know who I am. You don't know what I've done. You don't even know what's in the trunk of this car. All I'm doing is playing up to what he thinks I am. I said, so if I get pulled over and get hemmed up because you're smoking a joint in my car, yeah, not going to be a good day. So he crunches it. Matter of fact, I think he ate it. And
I do have to add for those listening, that was a very intimidating speech that you made to him, but you are intimidating anyway, because of your size. What, you're about 6'4", 260 pounds. I think anything you said to him would make him want to eat the joint.
It depends. Not that I really have an ego these days, but I appreciate you saying this thing. Yeah, it depends on the crowd you're in, right? I walk into some crowds, you're nothing, but some crowds, who knows, you know? But yeah, so I say that to him, but I do have a stern look on my face. In most of my undercover roles, I'm me. I'm still Scott. I may or may not be married. I may or may not have kids. I may or may not have played college ball, may or may not be a musician, but generally, you know, I lift weights and probably ride motorcycle. But when I'm doing a closer role or a murder for hire role, there's just no point in me even really joking around in my mind because you're supposed to be a killer. You're supposed to be somebody providing a bomb or something like that. Yeah, I say that to him. We pull into a gas station. I think we get some beer or something. When we pull into the parking lot in Myrtle Beach of the hotel, I'm pretty sure we were at Broadway at the beach. Might've been a Hampton Inn or something. Benji gets out of the car and he puked. Now, I don't know whether he puked because he was nervous or whether he ate the weed and it was sitting bad in his stomach. Yeah, me and the source even kind of look at each other. But here's the thing. I say this when I was being interviewed for the article too. Sometimes you just run into people and they're like, oh, you know, look at you. Like you just mentioned, I'm 6'4", 260. Sometimes I was 275, whatever, in my younger days. Some people might look at a picture of Benji and go, wow, this dude looks kind of odd. What I like to tell people is if you saw the picture of the Columbine kids before Columbine had, what would you say about those two kids? Dressed all goth, skinny, long trench coats. If you're not part of that scene, you may think they're weird. What would you say about the Aurora shooter before that happened, if you saw a picture of him?
Orange, yeah, with orange hair.
Yeah, right. Dylan Roof, you know, what would you say about him before he murdered all those people in Charleston, South Carolina?
That he had a strange, weird haircut.
Yep, he had a bowl haircut, which, by the way, there's a white supremacy group called Bowl Patrol, basically put him up on the pedestal.
Oh, great.
But yeah, if you saw that skinny kid with a gold gym tank top and the rebel flag, what would you say? But at the end of the day, dead is dead. You're still dangerous. They can still be dangerous. And that's the big thing, really, with a lot of the domestic terrorism stuff, because there's no domestic terrorism statute. We're basically trying to grab whatever crime they're doing to get them off the street. It's just tough sometimes.
So when you looked at, and I don't know if we've said his full name or we want to say his full name.
You can.
All right. So I'm looking at press release from when he was sentenced, and his full name is Benjamin Thomas Samuel McDowell.
Yes.
Poor names.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's kind of surprised me. You know, I was like, okay.
All right. So when you first see Benji, and I know you just explained to me how you see somebody weird and you not really don't know if they have what it takes to do what they say they want to do. What was your first assessment of him? I mean, you said weird, but did you?
Yeah.
If you just saw him, would you think that this is somebody who's planning to kill a lot of people attending synagogue?
No, not, and that's the thing. I teach all over the country. I'm blessed enough to still be doing that. That's the thing. I'm a tactical guy as well. But in the tactical world, we literally have a saying that says, don't name it. In other words, like we're doing here. We're doing it because we're going over cases, but for tactical stuff, we won't name. We'll name every victim from Columbine, but we won't name the shooters because that's really what they're trying to get fame. So you don't do that. That's the thing. There's no boilerplate. What does an active shooter, mass shooter look like? What does a white supremacist look like? I mean, goodness gracious, do they walk around with a hood on, pulled over their head? No. I'm not one of these people that sees somebody goes, oh my goodness, this one's legit. I'm more on the opposite end. I want to see nothing surprises me, but I'm just going with the flow. So my first impression was no, but I will tell you, as we explain what happened in the meeting at the hotel, yeah, this guy was serious in my book. So we get to the hotel, we go in, and we're just kind of getting to know each other. But he repeatedly keeps saying, man, I've got the heart. Man, I've got the heart. I just don't have the smarts to put it together. He had already picked out a synagogue. He knew that one of the weekends coming up, they were having a family day. He had already looked at it. So if the family day is going to be out in the parking lot, he could just come in and start mowing down people. What really stuck out to me is his work. And by the way, when I met him, Dylan Roof was on trial. And if you remember, Dylan Roof represented himself at trial in Charleston, South Carolina. Here I am with Benji, and Benji says, I want to do something in the style of Dylan Roof, but on a grander scale. And he's even talking about after he does it to like graffiti, basically paying homage to Dylan Roof. When it comes down to undercover work, if you do your job right, the evidence is so overwhelming. The defense, the only thing the defense can really do is argue entrapment or try to make you look like a piece of trash on the stand. And that's it, because the evidence is so overwhelming.
Right. That's the saying. If you can't attack the evidence, attack the investigator.
Exactly. You know, hey, Agent Payne, I couldn't help but notice how many times on the camera over the 2-year period, I saw a Jack and Coke coming up to your mouth, you know, stuff like that. And then you have to point out, yeah, but did you also see me pour it out in the bathroom when you're trying to keep your wits about you? We start getting into this almost pain back and forth. Number one, I'm not going to give this guy the tools he needs, right? Tell him, hey, the light system's here, camera's over here. You set up in this wood line kind of thing, wait till this time of day, you can do that. So the way I kind of played it, it played out very slow, but he was kind of, you could just see the anger and the willingness to do whatever. And again, he'd already been to jail from a broken home, didn't have a lot, stereotypical kind of in that aspect. He keeps saying, I got the heart, man. And I kind of played it like, look, I can't tell you what to do for the cause. Your heart's going to tell you what you want to do. I'm not going to tell you what all I've done for the cause, but I've been in this game for a long time and I've done a lot of stuff, but I'm not where I'm at by making stupid mistakes. There's some other things that when you're dealing with kind of murder for hire, this type of thing, where somebody's looking to do something bad, we're trying to find out how much you have planned, what tools you have or what means you have to carry out this thing. We also want to make sure that we're the ones that have the contract. In other words, Jerry, if you're coming to me and you're hiring me, I want to make sure that you and I bond so that you're not out shopping for other people to help you do what you're doing. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when you're allowing it to play out over a period of time. The fear that they're planning this with somebody else who's willing to move faster was always there.
Yes. I just remember sitting there going, man, how much longer can we keep this meeting going? I mean, if you're a bad guy with a lot of experience, you're probably going to start thinking, at least I'm thinking, I'm like, why are we not closing this deal? What's your problem kind of thing? We play around with it and I find out, hey, he got locked up in Horry County, which is Horry. And that's the kind of Myrtle Beach area. And that's also the area he was wanting to do this synagogue shooting. I'm like, well, aren't you kind of known in this area? So what I'm trying to do is win his trust, be his supplier if and when he decides to do something bad, and maybe slow roll it, blow this thing down a little bit. So we had that long meeting. He's pretty set on some things. And again, talking to him, like I told you before, I'm not one of these people who goes, oh my gosh, this is the worst person ever, blah, blah, blah. But I took him back to his house and I came back to the case team and I explained it just like I told you just now. I'm like, I'm not one of these people that's over the top. This is the worst person ever. I kind of look at everything in totality and I'm desensitized to a lot of stuff. But I told the case team, I said, I am 99.9% sure out of 100%. If I was really a bad guy and I told that kid what to do and I handed him the weapon, he would go do it. I said, but I'm also absolutely confident that if and when he decides to do something, he's going to reach out to me or the source. So I felt comfortable with that. So the case team, we talk, we break. We're going to be flying back the next day, traveling back the next day. So that night, I'm at the hotel with a couple of acquaintances having a cocktail or two, and my undercover phone goes off, and I'm like, well, crap, I've already turned in my recording equipment to the case team because I'm flying back the next day or driving, and it's Benji. So I quickly download an app on the phone that can record, basically some like call recorder. I think it's better than nothing. And I call him back and I step outside and we're talking, and he says, hey, you know, I like what you were saying. I am too known around here. I've already been a felon. The cops are on to me. He said, so I'm going to try to pick another spot outside of this area. In other words, outside of Horry County. But he said, hey, between now and then, you think you could get me a 40? Well, I immediately responded. I didn't even skip a beat. I go, absolutely, man. What do you want? Glock, Sig, Rammy, what do you like? And that's how we started rolling from there. I stayed in touch with him. And it took, I can't remember how many weeks it was, but usually with murder for hires or closer deals like this, they're pretty quick, generally 2 to 3 meetings, at least in my experience.
You had mentioned this. He's talking about doing it someplace where he's not known. I'm just a regular citizen reading the newspaper, watching the news. And in the news, when they talk about some of these, there is a suicide theme to these kind of mass killings. It seems like the shooter plans on dying. They're going to be committing suicide. But in the case of Benji, he seems like he's willing to move to a location where the cops don't know him because he's planning on surviving.
Correct. In some of the cases I've done, they do mention what you said. Hey, if they come to get me, I'm going down to the blaze of glory, die a martyr kind of thing. Try to be a saint, try to make the saint board. That's covered in the Rolling Stone article, but a lot of these white supremacists, they have a board and it's got Breivik. They refer to him as Saint Breivik. Dylan Roof is Saint Roof. Bowers is Saint Bowers. And you just go down the list, basically who has the most kills at the top of the list. A lot of people are saying they want to make the list kind of thing. Benji, even though he wasn't calling them saints, he was right there in that mindset because he had already said he wanted to do something in the style of Dylan Roof, but on a grander scale, which means he wants to kill more than Dylan Roof did. And I never heard him, I don't remember him saying that he would go down in a blaze of glory. But when he called me on the phone and put that recording app on there, he said, man, I like that idea. You seem pretty smart. I'm going to pick a different location where they don't know me. And I called the case team and said, man, you're not going to believe it. He just called and said, hey, we did good. He wants the gun and we'll start working on that. And that's kind of what we did. I can't remember how many weeks it went on. As I was saying before, a lot of these murder for hire or closer type deals, they'll get more than like 2 or 3 meetings. Generally, there might be a lot of back and forth on a phone or texting, but I just remember that Myrtle Beach, the resident agency out of Columbia, South Carolina. So Columbia is the headquarters city in South Carolina. Myrtle Beach is an RA. They were working hard on getting all their stuff together. The indictments, I was on the phone with the AUSAs and stuff. I do remember being on a call. Not to badmouth anybody, it's just that these are facts. You're on a call with a bunch of people that are coming up with ideas on how to give this kid a gun. And I guess the AUSA at the time didn't have a lot of experience. And he said that he had talked to, I guess, someone at ATF. He said he talked to someone at ATF and he said they do these a lot. His idea was that I was going to hand Benji a fully loaded operable weapon. And on the call, I kind of giggled a little bit and I said, so I'm just going to talk to you as a principal tactical instructor and an undercover coordinator, not the UC on this case. That is a bad idea. Why are we going to hand this thing a lethal weapon that works? He's already said he wants to kill people.
And he thought that was necessary to prove that he was willing to go through with it?
Yes. On that call at that point in time, yes. It was his lack of experience with these types of cases. And I said, there's absolutely no way. We can file down firing pins. We can do things that'll make that weapon inoperable. Generally, when you're a felon in possession of a firearm, every bullet is a separate count. But, you know, again, I'm not entrapping this kid. He wants it. He tells me how many bullets he wants. He wants what size of gun. Okay, so if he's got 2 magazines of 15 a mag, well, that's 30 counts of a felon in possession. I just remember that happening, and I was like, wow, that was different. But luckily, we made it out of there. I was pretty firm. I'm like, I'm not going to hand this kid a fully operable weapon and then us try to effect an arrest. That's not smart at all.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that second part of it.
Yeah. I remember getting a call because I guess Benji had run into something at his house or something, and he was done. He was over it. He was already saying, hey, I'm moving to Alabama or somewhere. He goes, I'm coming out to be with my brothers and sisters. All this crazy rhetoric talk. So we get notified, and basically I have to drop what I'm doing in Tennessee and haul butt down to Myrtle Beach while they're busting their tail to get their complaint done, at least to effect an arrest. I remember going down and I got there late at night. I told him, I said, hey, man, I'm coming through. Instead of you getting a buzz and stuff, because we were concerned, clearly concerned, the case team was concerned. If he absconds, if he hops on a bus and goes somewhere and we don't have any, he didn't really have a phone. We don't know how to track this guy. Where is he going? So we don't want to let him out of our sight. I hotel down there, got a little bit of sleep, got it the next day. And I just remember it being a monsoon. I remember going to pick up Benji at his house. He's got all these bags of clothes and stuff. We swing by his grandfather's house so he can get some money that he was owed or something. And he was going to use that money to buy the weapon from. We stopped to get something to eat. I mean, it was raining sideways. The wind's blowing. You know, it wasn't hurricane season. It was February. I don't know what the storm front came from, but it was nasty. We go into the hotel. I say, hey, this is yours. And, you know, for 1 second, he's like, well, you know, you can hold it. I'm not holding on to it. You asked me for this stuff. You've been asking me for this thing for like weeks, months, however long it's been. Here it is. You gave me the money. Here it is. So we're walking out to the car to head to Alabama or wherever he wanted to go. And that's when the case team comes in and effects the arrest. There's so many ways you can do that. Take down as an undercover. I was a vice narcotics investigator at my sheriff's office well before I became an FBI agent. So you do a lot of buy bust type stuff where for the people that don't know is exactly what it sounds like. I walk up, I'm getting the dope, team comes in, boom, they take everybody down. In this case, I give the kid his gun. We start walking out to my rental car when we're walking out, and I'd put it in a good spot where it's open parking lot area for tactical advantage for the team. And they came in and they arrested me as well, made it look like that. Sometimes you can just be, hey, I'm an FBI agent right there on the spot. Or sometimes you may get arrested with them because they're trying to find out some more stuff. I do remember one of the task force officers I made buddies with because he's a former NYPD guy and my first office in the FBI was in New York. So we were cutting it up. They get me and he slams my head off the side of the SUV and it wasn't hard. It just sounded really bad. We were laughing about it later because I was like, wow, man, you guys took that pretty serious. And then shoving me into a car, it went good. Nobody got hurt. Benji gave up. I said, do you guys need me for anything? Do you want me to come back to the office with you? And they're like, no, Scott, you're good. You're cut loose. I was starting to head back to Tennessee. Well, I get a call shortly into my trip. And they said, look, we just interviewed him. He came clean on everything. And he told them, he said, I'm glad you guys got me because I was really getting ready to do something bad. If there was any doubt, whether it was just talk, would he have followed through with it? What I was reading, was it right or wrong in my eyes or in the case team's eyes? We were right. He fully admitted it, that he was getting ready to do something really bad. Chalk a win up for the good guys and live to fight another day.
Absolutely. I'm hoping that he pled, that there was no trial or need for that.
No, he pled. I remember the case agent, great guy, reached out to me and told me, you know, he pled. So it was good. And again, that's the thing with all this rhetoric online and in groups. It's less face-to-face these days, it seems like, because everybody's in a chat room or web app or Wire, Telegram. Threema, there's so many and they keep popping up. I don't have my thumb on the pulse anymore because I'm retired. As I said at one of my teachings, I gave them like a 10, 15 minute break. And in that 15 minute break, I have different people coming up to me from different organizations and different parts of the country. And they're like, hey, have you ever heard of this group? Hey, what do you know about this group? This, that, and the other. And I kind of started giggling. And when I got back up to speak to everybody, I said, hey, I really appreciate all of y'all coming up to me in the break and asking me all these things. I said, but I want you guys to understand I'm retired. And since I retired, I've made a conscious decision to stop hanging out with white supremacists. So I said, I don't have my thumb on the pulse anymore. But I said, if you look right here to my right, there's a whole section of analysts and agents from the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they will be more than happy to help.
Once you have a choice, then you decided you didn't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, I'm like, I could go hang out, but I don't think it's going to be worth it. I will tell you, it's something I thought of, and it may not even be good for your podcast. You may want to cut this out. While we're setting up all this stuff for Benji, I had this extreme kind of biker, bad guy look, long hair, long beard, earrings, skull rings on your fingers and stuff, leathered up because it's winter time. And I'm at that Hampton Inn at Broadway at the beach. And I guess there was I don't know if it was a cheerleading convention or something big. It could have been like soccer or volleyball, but it was basically female driven. And there were some nice ladies.
Well, the moms.
Yes, the moms all there. So I go to get on the elevator and you could already feel the tension because she's very well dressed, probably middle upper class, something like that. Here I am looking like a heathen, as a good buddy of mine once said, sometimes we forget what a piece of trash we look like. And the elevator stopped. We were stuck in the elevator. We couldn't get out. And I'm like, oh boy,
the biker stuck in the elevator with the soccer mom.
Yes, exactly. I see her. You can see her peripheral vision. She is not looking at me, man. She's locked on to the buttons. I get on the little phone in the elevator and I call the front desk and I'm like, hey, we're on the elevator. And it just stopped. And I can hear people outside like banging on stuff. She goes, oh yeah, we're conducting maintenance. And I started laughing. I go, well, do you think they could have checked the elevator? I mean, there's only 3 floors in this hotel. I'm like, we're in New York and there's 80 floors in the building. So we were stuck. I said, well, can we get out? She's like, no, not till the maintenance is done. And I see this lady as nice as she can be. And I realize how bad it is. And I could see her nervous. And I just looked over at her and I said, ma'am, I know I look like a piece of trash. I said, but you have no idea how safe you are right now. I couldn't tell her I was an FBI agent. It went over pretty good. She played it off pretty good. I ended up getting Anthony to give us some free meal vouchers.
That was pretty good. And I guess that's the truth. I mean, there are so many FBI undercover roles that you have to look the part. And here you are, this upstanding citizen, sworn officer to protect the law and to protect people. But you look like one of the bad guys that are about to do some serious harm to those around them. How do you deal with that difference in your outward look and your inward personality?
I always tell people, look, man, I've got, and you know this, writing books and with all the stuff you've done, you run into people that just don't know our world. I've seen it, and I hate to see it, but you see people that talk to, I don't know, a journalist or a co-writer. They're telling them they do the best thing since sliced bread. Drop your ego. And I always tell them, I'm like, look, I've got mentors, I've got peers, and I've got people I've mentored. I've got lifelines, and I'm lifelines for other people. There are guys and girls out there that have done way more than me and more harrowing stuff than I've been through, and they're not getting this credit. So I always try to come from that aspect. For me personally, the only way I can say is, it's me. I never got a tattoo for a case. I always liked tattoos. I had tattoos when I came in the bureau. I had earrings when I came in the bureau. For most of my life, my hair was long and in a ponytail. I will say, as I've aged, it's not as thick as it used to be.
Oh, I know all about that.
I've donated my hair to Locks of Love 3 times, and that third time, it didn't come back too good. It's all right. For me, I'm Scott. I'm a biker guy. I like to ride motorcycles. I like to lift. I'm an outgoing, boisterous, loud personality. Sometimes that fits great. Sometimes it doesn't fit at all. You just have to be honest with yourself. But that's my skill set. I've got so many friends and people I admire and respect the world of. Men and women in the undercover program, that they do different things than me. I've got several good friends, and I mean, they're like doing Al-Qaeda. They're doing Fortune 500 company stuff. They're on yachts. They're in 5-star hotels, and I'm in the backwoods with meth heads, people with their not great hygiene. At a certain point in your career, I just kind of smile. I look over, and there's a meth head in the passenger seat of my truck who's hired me and somebody else to do 4 home invasions and murder 2 people. They're clawing themselves and tweaking. And I just look over and they're saying some pretty gross things that we've talked about offline, but I won't do it on your podcast. And I just look and smile and go, these are my people. This is what my skill set brings me to.
That's your niche. Your undercover niche.
Yeah. I think the best I could do is suit it up with some of our mafia guys, like the Jack Garcias and Pistones and people like that. I would just be muscle. All I can do is stand there and just be quiet and look mean.
Well, that's a role too. We forgot to end our case review. So let me just ask you the question. It's great that he did enter a plea. What was the sentencing? What was he sentenced to? And are you the type that is concerned about whether the sentence is enough or adequate? I got the sentencing report here and he got a range of 27 to 33 months.
If he got 27 or so months, no, I don't think that's enough time. It depends on, and you know this from all the stuff you've done of being an agent, it depends on the district you're in. It depends on the AUSA at the time. But I will say that the federal system is way more consistent than the state systems, which is why a lot of task forces are formed and a lot of state and local agencies want to take their cases federal because they're more consistent. Yeah, he should have got 5 to 10, in my opinion.
Well, I'm looking at the press release from the sentencing, and it says, in mitigation, defense counsel emphasized, among other things, McDowell's mental health issues and limited intellectual functioning.
Yeah. I mean, look, was he the sharpest tool in the toolbox or the sharpest knife in the drawer? Maybe not, but who in their right mind is thinking about massacring families at a synagogue family day event? That's my opinion. I remember going through college and debating and getting into all these things. And you're just like, well, the insanity plea. I'm like, well, who's sane at the time you're stabbing somebody 50 plus times? You're kind of out of your mind at that moment. I mean, that's just my opinion.
The reason I bring it up is because so many of the recent cases that you've seen where the Bureau has gone after domestic terrorism groups and they've thwarted a plan that they had to commit some type of crime, the other side often says they were entrapped and they were just talking and they were just planning, but they weren't really going to go through with it, and that it was the FBI that pushed them to the next stage where the plan became doable.
So that goes back to what we were talking about. They can argue entrapment or try to make you look like a bad person. Speaking for myself, if you do the undercover technique the way it's supposed to be done, that's like 101 entry level undercover. We don't entrap. You got to be predicated. And for the audience listening, if you don't know, I mean, like, I can't come in and go, hey man, I got $100,000 for you and you're broke and I'm asking you to do something you've never even brought up. You're not predicated at all to do. Well, yeah, that's going to be an entrapment issue. But if you've come to us or the bad person, you're already talking. I mean, like the outlaw case, the day I met them and they found out that I was from the border, they asked me for dope right away. So a year and a half in, when we actually do somewhat of a drug deal, they've been predicated forever. Again, I think it depends on your AUSA, your United States Attorney's Office. Some want more. Some say, hey, you know, this is good enough. In other words, in order to get Benji for a felon in possession, he had to give me money in exchange for the weapon. I actually handed him the weapon. He had the weapon on his person. That's good enough for that AUSA. I've done deals where we delivered a dope shipment that had been intercepted on the West Coast. It's supposed to come to the East Coast. So we do an exact replica of the shipment. And that AUSA says, I'm not okay with you just dropping the box off to these people that are expecting this drug shipment. That's not enough for me. I want to make sure they open it. So they installed a switch. So once we drop off the drugs and we pull away, we get notified when the box is actually open. So that shows that, look, they did go further through with it. But I see what you're saying. That's a big argument with the rhetoric stuff. When you're online, there's people spewing all kinds of hate, but which one is dumb enough to go out and do it? Which one is going to take those steps to commit that bad crime? It's an ebb and flow. It's tough.
Right. And what do they want us to do? Wait until they actually do it?
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's when they come back and say the FBI failed in stopping this terrorist act from happening. It's a tough deal, one that we've accepted, and we've got agents and people out there today working to prevent the next mass shooting, terrorist act, et cetera.
Yes, ma'am. And the lone wolves are the tough ones. And at least in this case, even though it was white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan or United Klans of America, which by that time they were saying they were white separatists, because supremacist brings a more negative connotation. This is the way it was explained to me when I was naturalized with the Klan. They're like, on the other side of that tree line, we don't care if everybody there is brown, black, whatever. We just want this part for us. And I go, okay.
I'm not buying either way, though.
Yeah, I'm not.
Well, you mentioned people that you knew working undercover, people that had gone before you. So I wanted to talk a little bit about why you wanted to become an undercover agent, because there are many agents, including myself, that weren't interested, not necessarily in playing the role, but being away from our families and those type of sacrifices that you have to make when you are a long-term undercover agent. So what was it about it that pulled you into wanting to do it?
Funny you ask that, because we've had to dive into that topic pretty deeply into the book that I've been blessed enough to get a book deal. If you look back at your history, once you grow up, you can look back and say, okay, I was in high school in the late 80s. At my high school, there was a smoking section. I could go hang out there, hang out with the smokers. There were the potheads. I could hang out with them. There were the jocks. I could hang out with them. There were the musicians. I could hang out with them. I was just a people person, I guess. That may not always work for every case, but I've been blessed in my cases. So when I became a cop, after 3 years in uniform, I made vice of narcotics. That was my first official covert buys or whatever. I remember the first crack rock I bought. I mean, I was probably like 275 pounds. I didn't look like a crackhead. My trainers on the narcotics squad, they take this $20, drive down the street, pull up to that corner, and when they come up to the window, just tell them you want a 20. I didn't know anything about buying crack. I was a beefy white guy. So I pulled down And they come up to my window and they're like, what you want? I remember cracking that window so small. It was like I was putting money into an ATM because I was so scared. My voice is all high and I'm like, I want a 20. And they give me a little sliver of day, but it probably was so. I wasn't even smart enough to know I was being ripped off. So I got the bug for it. And I even thought in South Carolina back then to get an undercover certification or even technical surveillance certification, all that stuff, you had to go to the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy. It's located in Columbia, South Carolina. So you go when you get your certification. And I remember thinking, man, there's only so many ways at Greenville County, where I work, that you can shave your beard, cut your hair, change vehicles before you're just known. And I thought, we all got certified at the same place. Wouldn't it be great if they had some kind of database or something, like a list of undercovers with their skill sets to say, hey, Charleston County needs a biker guy to come down and make some buys. That would be awesome if the sheriffs and the chiefs had that, is what I was just thinking. And then when I made it in the Bureau, I found that's kind of what we had. You know, you get certified in the FBI undercover program and you can go anywhere. I've always been drawn to it, even movie wise. I loved every undercover movie there was. One of my mentors at the narcotics unit in Greenville County, he was the world's strongest man in the late 80s. He's a former Marine and he traveled the world powerlifting and won the worlds in the 275 class, bench, squat, and deadlift. This dude was a beast and I was definitely in awe of him. But he had done a biker undercover as a task force officer. I think it was with the FBI. And man, I just really being so enthralled with that and the undercover technique. So when I got in the Bureau and I started learning more about the FBI's undercover program, that's all I wanted to do. You were in Philadelphia, right?
Yep. Most of my career.
Big division there. New York's the biggest. I've seen like a Jack Garcia full-time, you see. It's just very rare. I was in the New York field office. I was in San Antonio, but I was down in McAllen RA and then Knoxville. You're required to be a case agent first. You know, I was SWAT. I was a tactical instructor, firearms instructor, active shooter instructor, all these other things, undercover coordinator, active undercover. Those are all collateral duties. So you're required to be a case agent first. It's very rare, at least in my experiences, that you're told, okay, you're full-time SWAT. Okay, you're a full-time firearms instructor when you're assigned to a division.
At least one of the smaller ones.
Yes. Yeah. I think two cases I had, they listed me as full time, but for me, it was pretty rare.
I guess we should go back to the beginning and I can ask my standard question, which is not just why you wanted to do undercover, but why you wanted to join the FBI in the first place. So when and why did you join the FBI?
Kind of a funny story. I'm working by some narcotics and I am with my sergeant, who another former Marine. Had a Fu Manchu, Popeye forearms with the Marine tattoo on his forehead. He literally looked like a bulldog. He was kind of built like him. And we're out on surveillance one day. My nickname on the squad at that point was, I think, Kingpin or something. I graduated from Busman, you know, tough crowd. He told me, he said, you know, Kingpin, if I was young and single like you and I had a degree, he said, I would apply for the FBI and I would put New York as my first office. And I was like, what? Because I had little exposure to the FBI. The only time I ever saw the FBI was they were doing bank robberies. Drugs was DEA. And he's like, no, son. He said, they did everything in the FBI. He said it was one of the hardest to get hired with. Well, at a 5-year point at the sheriff's office, I knew I wanted to go federal, but I was looking at where am I going to be in 5 years as far as pay and rank and stuff goes. Not that it's the be all end all, but, you know, trying to prepare for a future. I applied with the FBI and I had the DEA application. I started my name. That's all I got because the FBI would keep contacting me back. And I went through the phase one and phase two and interviews and then the polygraphs and everything. And I got selected. I came in the last class of the fiscal year of 1998. So we were 98-17. By the way, my first office was New York City and I didn't pick it. It was like 36 on my list. So
it was like fate. Yeah. The person that suggested you apply, they saw it. They saw it coming.
I let him have it. When I went back to the going away party and load up all my stuff from the storage unit to move to New York, I'm like, you jinked me. But it was good. FBI, to me, was the pinnacle. And listen, there's been times in my career where I'm thought, and you know what? I'm going to go to DEA. I was just in a bad place. But that's when I started learning, started maturing and realizing if you got a bad supervisor, they're going to come and go. You got a good one, they're going to come and go. Just keep doing your job. Put your nose to the grindstone. Be a good case agent. Develop sources, get information, generate new cases. But the undercover technique, to me, is one of the best techniques we use. It is a sophisticated investigative technique the SACs, the heads of the FBI offices, can check that block. It's the same credit as doing a Title III wiretap. Even with all this technology, at the end of the day, you need to be able to sit down with somebody and have a conversation and get information from them. Anytime my collateral duties ever had conflicts, whether it's SWAT or whatever, undercover always won. I'm just so passionate about it. And I'm not being biased. I just don't know any department in the DOJ that has an undercover program like the FBI. We have a very tough certification process. That's just once you get to the school. I mean, to get to the school, to get a slot in a desk for those 20 slots, that's a trial in itself. And then if you get certified and you're blessed enough to make it through, become certified, well, now you got to get out there and start helping it and try to find work. On paper, I'm a white guy with no foreign language, so I would just call the undercover unit every 2 weeks and be like, hey, you know, my nickname was Big Country. Hey, how's it going? They're like, what's going on, Big Country? I said, you got anything for any country guys with no foreign language? And then they'd be like, nope. 2 weeks later, I'd call again. Hey, it's me. Y'all got anything? Because I didn't know how to search and stuff. Eventually, I got called to role play at the UC school, and that's when I started getting noticed. I was blessed. I had some very, very good people take me under their wings.
We mentioned our mutual friend, Jack Garcia, who I know will listen to this, so we'll just say hi to him now.
Hello, Jack.
Because I know him from Philly. He's a great guy. He's a sweet guy. He's like you, a really big guy and intimidating, but just a little puppy dog at heart.
I love that guy. So New York's my first office. You do the rotation. It takes forever. But I finally get to my first squad, which is C-23, the Colombian Drug Squad. Well, he was in the sister squad just over the bridge in Brooklyn, Queens, RA. I remember him walking through the New York office, and I'm like, who is that guy? He's coming through our area. And they're like, that's Jack Garcia. He's a whole time undercover. It just bugs me that in our industry, it just seems that it's so hard for people to just say congratulations sometimes. People are always just not everybody, but it's just some people just try to pull the rug out from under you. I see somebody like Jack, I'm looking at him going, that dude is awesome. I want to go meet this guy. I want to learn. I'm drawn to people like that.
You retired, was it last year?
June 30th, 2021.
Since that time, you've been working on this book that we've been talking about.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a working title?
Right now, because there are so many titles that have been used out there by other people. The article titles, Rolling Stone was titled The Undercover Nazi. We did not pick that. We had picked The Infiltrator or something to that effect. And I remember getting a call one night from the author, Paul Solitaroff, who wrote the article, The Journalist. And he's like, oh man, I'm so sorry they changed the title. He goes, it's terrible. And I'm like, what did they name it? He goes, Undercover Nazi. I'm like, that is terrible.
I was thinking the same. I wasn't sure what you thought about it.
Well, I'm like, it makes it sound like I'm a Nazi. I'm not a Nazi. I was pretending to be a Nazi. He's like apologizing. I'm talking to him. And I go, wait a minute, Paul. I got this to say, multi-million-dollar company with magazines all over the world in foreign languages. You can't tell me there's not people sitting in a room looking at algorithms and hot topics. And they were right. Per Paul and Rolling Stone, that's the most downloaded article since they've been keeping track of downloads.
It definitely makes you want to, like, what?
Yeah, I know, right? So the working title right now for the book is Pale Horse, How I Became the Undercover Nazi. So it kind of takes you through.
That's better.
Because Pale Horse was my moniker in the base. And that was like one of the last big cases I did. Malicious stuff. It may still be aggravated, but I didn't do that. The last big adjudicated, everything taken down case was the base, pretty much. When we were writing the book, it's just how I became this, how I've learned. There's a lot of stuff. First two chapters are basically a little window view of me growing up, some skill sets that might lead to being undercover, and how I became a cop. Chapter two is like cop, life of narcotics, little scary drug buy incidents here and there, and then you're into the FBI. And then starting at chapter three is pretty much all undercover stuff.
Is this case that we reviewed today, is there a chapter on that, or does it?
Yes, ma'am. It'll be in there kind of with the KKK stuff. 2 years in the Outlaws, a lot of stuff happened on that case. I'm diving a lot more into the family too, and my faith. That's why I wanted this one editor. We were doing interviews, and this one editor out of New York, who's unbelievable, picked up on my faith. And he's like, hey, is that kind of like a whole life thing? Or is it just, I said, no, it's my whole life. I said, don't get me wrong. I've strayed off the chalk line and lived in the flesh, as we say. He picked up on it. He said, I want you to talk about your faith through the whole book. And I remember being kind of surprised about that. So we ended up with him, and it's going to be about my faith and my family. What a lot of people don't talk about, at least in my experience and with a lot of my peers, you can sit in training all day and hear 10 great success stories of how everything went perfect on a case. Nobody remembers that.
they remember from people making mistakes, and I've made plenty. You get to see that. You get to see sad stuff. You get to see happy stuff. You get to see the beating your family takes. And maybe at the time I didn't realize it. And maybe I didn't find out some of it until we started doing this book. Me and my wife had to dive back into some rougher times to kind of remember stuff. I found out things I didn't know, but there will be no FBI bashing in this book.
That doesn't have that? It seems like lately a lot of people are bashing when there's so many great stories. I mean, the FBI is not perfect. We can let other people talk about that, especially when it's speculation. I'm glad to hear that your book is going to talk about,
things.
And if it's bad things, it's bad things that you personally experience.
Yeah, but I'm not even going to do that. Like, I'm talking to some good peers, lifelines of mine, and you start looking at it, and I'm like, look, I'm not coming down on anybody. Hey, if you want to put your story out there and it's a bad light on the FBI, then do it. I'll back you up, but it's just not me. I'm not going to do it. Could I? Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of things. Just like anybody's career, you can come up
where
things are bad. But I'm trying to pay it forward. I don't want to tarnish the badge. All it takes is one incident, and then all law enforcement pays the price for sometimes years. I just don't see a place for it in my book.
I think that's a great point. I got something on Instagram. Somebody sent me a message yesterday wanting me to talk about the Durham report and answer to some questions. And I just said, some retired agent is going to do that for you.
Yeah.
But that's not what I do. I've got my own niche, and my mission here is to tell you who the FBI is and what the FBI does through case reviews from the people that work the cases. That's what I do, and that's what you'll get when you listen to this show.
I'm the same way. There was a guy a long time ago. He was an agent. We did not get along, but he said something very wise one day. This is way back. He said, do you want to be part of the solution or part of the problem? And I've used it ever since. I love law enforcement. I'm a law and order guy, even though I'm retired, semi-retired. I'm not a peace officer anymore, although I do have a sheriff on speed dial just in case I need to get a day job. But I still go out and train. I teach active shooter stuff. I go and speak. And I know the stuff I speak about, the undercover stuff, it's got a shelf life. Eventually, it won't be up to date or a hot topic. But as far as going out and being around law enforcement and helping people, not only are you teaching, you're learning. I learn something every time I teach a new class. I'm all for law enforcement. I love the FBI. I'm a country guy from South Carolina. My dad dropped out in the 10th grade, but I didn't have to hurt too much growing up. He had a landscaping company. And before your big Walmarts and Home Depots and Lowe's, he had the third largest landscaping company in Greenville, South Carolina. And all of a sudden, I go into law enforcement, and then all of a sudden, I get in the FBI. And here I am sitting at the pool on a cliff right on the Hudson River in New Jersey, and I'm looking at the skyline of New York City thinking, how in the heck did I make it here? There's no way. There's story after story, much like many FBI agents. You can do pretty much as you want or as little as you want. But I've been blessed. I look at it as a total blessing all the way through.
I look forward to getting a copy and reading your book when it comes out. For this particular episode, I encourage everyone to go to the show notes and check out the Rolling Stone article, which will give you that taste that I talked about of what's going to be in your book. At the end of every episode, I like to give my guest the last word. What would you like to say?
I'll hit on a couple of things I've already said. I'm an alert instructor. That's an organization that the FBI married in 2013 after the Sandy Hook school shootings. The Department of Justice came in and said, look, we want somebody to run all the, take the lead on the active shooter training. It was the FBI. So now that I'm retired, you apply as an adjunct. So I'm out teaching for alert. And at the end of the week, you stand up there and I thank everybody for the men and women in blue for still doing the job. I thank them for continuing to fight the good fight because I'm retired. I said, we need you on that wall. Not to get all Jack Nicholson on you, but the bottom line is there's evil out there, and there are evil people on this planet that want to do evil things to good people. Some people don't understand that. I've got relatives that don't. Hey, you do you, but go back to your home and just be glad we're out here. So I thank them for that. I always say, please don't tarnish the badge. Pay it forward. That's a huge one for me, especially in retirement. I know younger, I was brash. I know I was probably considered cocky. And as you age, you learn better ways to teach. You learn better ways to communicate with people. And just remember, do the right thing. Sometimes we don't have to enjoy doing the right thing. I may rather just punch somebody in the throat than do the right thing. But you do the right thing because it is the right thing to do. pay it forward. Keep fighting a good fight. Just know that there's plenty of us out here that love you and support you.
And that's the end of the interview. In your podcast app's description of this episode, there's a direct link to the show notes where you'll find photos of Scott Payne, along with links to news articles about this case and that feature article in Rolling Stone magazine about Scott. There's also a link to other FBI case reviews with undercover agents and an episode focused on domestic terrorism. I hope you enjoyed the interview and that you'll share it with your friends, family, and associates. You can show me just how much you liked it by buying me a coffee. There's a link in your podcast app's description of this episode, or you can visit jerrywilliams.com and tap on the little coffee cup icon in the bottom right-hand corner of my website. Don't forget to follow FBI Retired Case File Review on your favorite podcast app. Now, this podcast is all about true crime, but if you're also interested in crime fiction, once a month via my reader team email, I keep you up to date on the FBI and books, TV, and movies. When you join my reader team, you get access to my FBI reading resource, a colorful list of more than 70 books about the FBI written by FBI agents who have been guests on this podcast. There's nonfiction, crime fiction, true crime, and memoirs. You'll also get my FBI reality checklist, where I debunk 20 cliches about the FBI and receive news about what I'm up to and about my FBI nonfiction and crime fiction books. I want to thank you for listening to the very end. I hope you come back for another episode of FBI Retired Case File Review with Jerry Williams. Thank you.